Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Raymond Tungekar, filling in for David Reed. This week, we'll revisit two of our favorite interviews from the past year. First up, we'll hear about the dangers editorial cartoonists face around the world. This interview was recorded back in May.
With a few sharp strokes, cartoonists with clever wits can make a point worth far more than 1,000 words. For centuries, hypocrisy and injustices by the political elites have been exposed by these drawings, and have often been the only way to work around text censorship. Now, joining us for today's program are Mark Fiore. He's president-elect of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. We also have Robert Bro Russell, the executive director of Cartoonists Rights International. Before we talk about specific cases, let's take a broader approach. So welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Okay. Bro, we'll start with you. Why does a cartoon cause such strong reactions? After all, it's usually supposed to be sarcastic or satirical.
What happens is that as we make fun of political figures and social and cultural figures, we, the observers and the cartoon readers, feel better. But nobody likes to be laughed at. Nobody likes to be made fun of. It's a universal experience. Now, when you're in the political sphere, if you're an elected official or you even take over a country with a gun, it's part of the territory. Criticism is part of the territory, and you have to understand that if you want to be the head of state, if you want to run the country, then this is part of the territory. You're going to be criticized. And cartoonists are so good at it because we use humor, we use laughter, we make fun of people. And particularly despots and tyrants and people who are in power only because of perhaps the power of the gun, this seems extremely rude and intolerable. And while you are someone ruling with a gun, then you have a gun to do something about it.
All right. Mark, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I would actually take one step back from that and get to a slightly simpler point before that even, and that's just the power of a visual message is a lot stronger than something that's purely written. I mean, not to bash editorial writers, but when was the last time an editorial caused a huge uproar, compared to when a cartoon caused a huge uproar? I mean, just in the last few weeks, Jack Oman did an amazing cartoon that took after Rick Perry down in Texas, and the lieutenant governor called for him to be fired, and there was a humongous outcry. And it wasn't because it was an editorial or something that was mainly written going after the governor and criticizing his whole deregulation bent. It was because it was this great visual. Mm-hmm. And that's what cartoons do all the time. And I think that's the main reason why they grab people around the neck and make them notice.
What are some of the pressures and threats that editorial cartoonists are now facing? Mark, can you start off?
Sure. I'll leave the physical threats to Bro to handle, because he's dealing with people that are in repressive countries and places where, you know, just being a cartoonist puts you at risk. But for example, in the United States, the threats, while they fortunately they're physical threats to the cartoonist a lot less of the time, even though that does happen as well. It's more, economic threats that you have to be careful of here, whether it's self-censorship, trying to pull your punches, or editors trying to keep everything kind of a little calmer and being afraid to offend people.
Yeah, and Bro?
I deal with cartoonists who are at risk and who have been threatened. Cartoonist Rights Network International is really, we're really not a cartooning organization. We're a human rights organization, and we defend the free speech and human rights privileges of political and social cartoonists around the world. Right now, as we speak, we are trying to find out more about a cartoonist who has been disappeared inside of a very violent Middle Eastern country right now.
Right.
I don't even want to mention his name, and I don't even want to mention the country, because we're not sure whether this would make the situation better for him or worse for him.
That's
what
terrible.
What we're really trying to do right now is find out whether he's still alive or not. There's another cartoonist in another country in South Asia who is being attacked, and he's being harassed and attacked by, you can't say the police, but mm-hmm. you might say the secret police. They're beating him up on the street, running him over with motorbikes, threatening his family. He has right. had his passport stolen, and he doesn't know exactly stolen by whom. So mm-hmm. it's even difficult for him to get out of the country. There is another cartoonist from Bangladesh who we helped get out of the country after he was convicted and given a 7-year jail term for a cartoon that was deemed disrespectful to Islam.
All right, and there's another case of the Israel imprisoning the Palestinian cartoonist recently.
Yes.
So it's not just in countries that are having revolutions.
Yeah, Mohammed Sabane, a really wonderful, creative, and very sensitive cartoonist. We have a picture of him on one of our stories on our website, and he's sitting in front of the White House. He was the guest of the U.S. State Department on their annual visitors program a couple of years ago. They bring in a group of Middle Eastern cartoonists to take a tour of the U.S. every year. He had a wonderful time. He met so many American and Canadian cartoonists. His cartoons are always so gentle and powerful. But he's always very, very careful not to be racist and not to foment violence. But he was arrested by the Israeli Defense Forces, held incommunicado for about 3-4 months.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there was so much pressure to get him out of jail that they took him to court. There were some trumped-up charges against him, and I'm not sure if he's out yet. I think they said that he could serve his time as the time served,
mm-hmm.
but he may have another month on top of that. But we know it's because he was a journalist and a cartoonist that he was identified in the first place.
Right.
At least we're pretty sure.
And I want to get back to some of the specific cases with and actually and give examples of the cartoons they were drawing. But I wanted to have another broader question again. Mark, what are some of the other issues that cartoonists are now dealing with as the journalism profession overall is going through such a painful transition?
Well, I think a number of them over the last, you know, several years, just like other parts of journalism, a number of them are trying to preserve their jobs, whether that is on staff at a newspaper. Some of the smarter newspapers are actually hiring back cartoonists
mm-hmm.
That have been laid off previously, and other newspapers are actually not eliminating the cartoonist, but are keeping it because they know it's such a valuable position for a publication in a given city or state. So, but barring that, I'll say barring the smart publishers and barring the smart newspapers, some are getting shown the door, and those cartoonists are having to figure themselves out and figure out their next step. And I've said before that this isn't—it's not a death knell. It's potentially an opportunity to figure out how you're going to get your cartoons out there, how you're going to communicate directly to people, or how you're going to show your work in a different way. You know, it's a glass half empty, half full kind of thing, and I tend to fall on the glass half full side.
I wanted to ask you guys, it seemed like there's somewhat of a sea change in the dynamics of editorial cartoons after the Danish newspaper published those 12 cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad in 2005. You know, there were massive violent protests that deterred media outlets from publishing cartoons degrading Islam. And the most prominent of those cartoonists was they tried to kill him. So how did that – how did in retrospect, did that cause a lot of self-censorship? And is that impact still lingering?
Well, when I talked to Kurt Westergaard, I haven't spoken with him in about a year, but after this incident, I talked to him. And he said he and his wife are more committed than – and his whole family, he said, are more committed to free speech and telling the truth than they ever have been in their lives.
Right, and he was the cartoonist who depicted Muhammad with a bomb in his turban, right?
Yes, yeah. You know, it has woken up the whole journalism sector, I'll tell you. I've been doing this work for 20 years, and even the journalism support organizations that I work with and through sometimes have gone through a sea change in their view of the power of cartooning after the 12 Danish cartoons. Mm-hmm. Practically all the major journalism support organizations like Reporters Sans Frontières, Human Rights Watch, Committee to Protect Journalists, are all paying close attention to the power of cartoons now, and many of them have opened up cartoon sections on their websites.
Mm-hmm. Although I would say in the United States, It's been the opposite as far as self-censorship. I mean, the New York Times never actually ran those cartoons or showed their readers what was the issue that people were talking about. You know, cartoonists across the country haven't exactly been much quicker to draw Muhammad after that. And, you know, understandably, because of, you know, personal safety, and not to mention it's a lot harder to get something like that through a publisher. But I personally think that there are ways to do it, and, you know, and I've done it myself, but I think you have to do it with such care and mm-hmm. such caution that, you know, you need to show it in a respectful way. You need to show something that's forbidden like that in a respectful way and show why it's forbidden. You know, and I think overall, you know, in answer to the question, I think that it's increased self-censorship, at least around here.
Mm-hmm. Bro, I saw when I was looking at Ferzat's cartoons, there was a video collection of video interviews with the Arab cartoonists talking about how editorial cartoons played roles in the Arab Spring. Can you talk about the network of cartoonists and how that's changed.
Cartoonists, like any other political commentators or editorial writers, have a vastly wide base of political perspectives. You know, some are in favor of Mr. Mubarak and some are against Mr. Mubarak. What happened during the Arab Spring was that cartoonists of very, very different political backgrounds suddenly found themselves kind of all squished together, all pulling together, and all identifying with each other, you know, with the common enemies that they were dealing with, and instead of feeling loyalty to their own historical political perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, cartoonists came together in a very amazing way.
And Mark, can you talk about this and also where you see it going from here? I mean, it's hard to imagine where technology is going and how cartoonists can take advantage of it, but maybe your thoughts on some future trends.
On the technology side, I'm very hesitant to
yeah.
stick my neck out and make predictions because, honestly, in my career, I have largely just figured it out as I went along. I mean, you see some things coming down the pike, like when YouTube starts up or becomes popular, you know, you suddenly realize, wait, people are going to be able to put these on their blogs. People are going to be able to put videos all over the place. And it breaks down the walls a little bit. So I think things like that will continue, where you're going to, you know, combine technology like YouTube or something that allows cartoons or videos to get out there easier. You're going to combine that with social media even more. So it's going to be much more mm-hmm. tie in with the people directly rather
okay.
than having to go through an editor or a publisher.
Okay, bro,
so,
we have,
you know,
bro,
that's
bro, we have
the case, but it will continue too.
Okay. All right, thanks, Mark. Bro, well, we have just about 30 seconds. Your final word?
Editorial cartoons are I consider them the bravest, most intelligent, most innovative journalists in the world. I'm, of course, biased. But the reason I do what I do is because I'm just in awe of what they can do, as you said earlier in the introduction to the program, with just a few strokes of a pen. Governments can be taken down.
That was our interview with Mark Fiore. He's the president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. You also heard from Robert Bro Russell. He's the executive director of Cartoonists' Rights Network International. Next up, we'll hear an interview with a photojournalist who is held captive by militants in Syria. Last year, Global Journalist interviewed French-American photojournalist Jonathan Alperi as he was about to make his second trip into Syria. Several months later, he was captured by militants, held for ransom, and was just released in July of this year. We caught up with Jonathan back in September.
Jonathan, welcome back, and we're all grateful that you're safe and sound.
Thank you for having me.
As we said in our last interview, you've risked your life repeatedly to bring home photographs from nearly a dozen conflict zones, beginning in the South Caucasus as a freelancer in 2004. Why is it so important for journalists to get inside Syria despite the danger?
Well, Syria is a very difficult conflict to cover because of its violence, and it's, you know, the casualty rates, both military and civilians, are very high. The intensity of the fighting is also very intense. And so for that alone, for Western journalists to go inside, that's a challenge that I think can only be undertaken by people who have plenty of experience. And obviously, the conflict in Syria is strategically important due to its geography, situation in the Middle East, but the fact also that this war can spread out to different countries and become a major regional conflict.
And the Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders reports that at least 15 foreign journalists are missing or have been abducted or arrested in Syria. What's your sense of how many abductions and arrests have actually happened there in Syria?
Well, officially, it's between 12 to 15. I know for a fact through various sources that I can't mention in this interview, but there are more. Some have just happened very recently, actually. So, yeah, it's becoming more and more common for different reasons, as the rebellion is becoming a more and more Islamist-type fighting force. So these elements are more than happy to kidnap Western journalists for money or because they're Westerners or because they realize that the Western press is not going to help them in any way anymore.
And the regime's soldiers also have motivations for stopping journalists from reporting inside the country also. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's true. And we know also that a couple of these guys that have been missing for a while are in Syrian jails inside Damascus. And with, you know, we don't have any news. But I think the government has made a very big mistake to, you know, behaving like that towards us, especially because they didn't let us cover their side nearly as much as the rebellion has in the past.
And I was listening to a report from the editor of a news service who was saying that his reporters are facing or encountering more Islamic militants in Syria. They apparently their territory has spread in Syria. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I would add further to this with the notion that if you look at the first generation of fighters, rebel fighters who picked up arms 2.5 years ago to defeat the regime, I would say over 90%, 95%, even maybe close to 100% of them were moderate Muslims. So there you have doctors, lawyers, local peasants who picked up arms and, you know, started fighting. Now, a lot of these guys are dead now. Casualties are very high within the rebellion, probably close to between 30 or 40,000 killed and from my sources. So a lot of these, you know, first generation moderate Muslims, a lot of them have been replaced by more hardcore Muslims, Islamists, and foreign fighters inside the country.
All right. And let's talk about your experiences on this last trip. How was this different from your previous attempts to get inside the country?
Well, you come in from Turkey, so very different environment, different people. Syria is a very diverse nation ethnically. And obviously, when you start working close to Damascus, where I was going through Lebanon, that's very dangerous. Hezbollah is there. The border is much more controlled. The government is far more present because it's a very strategic area for them, and they need it far more than they need the northern part of their country.
Once you got inside, where did you go? What kind of subjects did you photograph?
Well, when I got in, I was shooting in a town called Yabrut, which is kind of a big town in some sort of the area that's more or less controlled by the rebellion. When I got in, things got worse quickly because the shelling got more and more intense. And so the government, you know, was more and more proactive in putting pressure on the rebels in the area. And then when I was captured, Qusair fell, and then Homs, and then Hezbollah got close to our positions. And, you know, we were being attacked on a daily basis, a lot of artillery fire, MiGs, helicopters. So every day, like, the military situation got more and more intense for me and the guys with me.
What happened to you? What were you doing when you were abducted?
I mean, the first month, the first 5.5 weeks, I was handcuffed, tied to a bed. The first about week, I was blindfolded, and they removed that. And after the first 3 weeks, I was in one house, and that was pretty tough. They did mock executions.
When you say mock executions, what do you mean?
Like, you know, once with pistol, one with a machine gun on my forehead, and once they came in with knives, pretended to cut my throat, stuff like that, accusing me of being a spy, a CIA agent, FBI, and so forth.
And they're trying to break you?
Yeah, they were trying to do that. They were trying to, I think they were also trying to force me to admit to things that I wasn't, you know, that I wasn't. But I never broke. I never agreed to any of it. So,
could you describe how you were captured?
Yeah, towards the end of my trip, I decided to convince my fixer to bring me to the south of the front line, about 30 kilometers north of Damascus, to do work with a local unit, rebel unit. Mm-hmm. And he got in on the deal with another fixer that I didn't know, who I think is the guy who sold me to these units. But I tell them in advance, there's Weston Joyce, photographer, coming in. So we got a car, we went to meet them, and they had a checkpoint waiting for me. The guys were wearing ski masks and, you know, machine guns. They dragged me out of the car, they took all my gear, put me on my knees, pretended to execute me with a pistol, then blindfolded me, handcuffed me, put me in a car, and then that's how it all began for me.
Can you describe who these men were?
So it seems that they're a local Katiba, which is a tactical unit, which varies from, you know, 10 guys to a few thousand. So it's great tactical differences. This local Katiba is probably the most powerful in that area where I was, and they control different villages, mountains, and stuff like that near Damascus. And they're the ones who caught me and kept me for 3 months.
Did you develop any good relations with them over time?
I did, and the reason why it worked out is because what I did is I tried to integrate as much as I could to their life. So I would pray with them. They even asked me if I want to convert, but I would always never really answer the question, but I never did, and I never would. And I would count ammunition with them. I would cook with them. So I really tried to be, you know, with them. I'd let my beard grow and try to be as much as they are, by learning the language as well and stuff like that. That they really appreciate it. So it made things simpler for me.
What would you say was the lowest points?
It's a good question. I would have to say, you know, when they came in with knives, pretend to execute me. Because being executed, you know, by a pistol or machine gun, I was okay with it. I was resignated, so I knew it was going to be quick and so on. But being executed by a knife, with a knife, that was a scary thought for me.
And when did you get a sense that you may be getting out?
I had no idea until it actually happened.
Oh, and what happened the day that you were released?
I can't tell you all the details for various reasons, but I was released by somebody who is close to the Bashar al-Assad regime. And apparently he paid my ransom. And he negotiated with various groups, and they agreed to take the money. And that tells you a lot about the kind of rebels that these people are, because, you know, they are Islamists and they are fighting against the regime, but they were also willing to take a lot of money for me to supply them with, you know, extra ammunition, weapons to keep on fighting. So it's a very gray area. It's not black and white, you know?
There are a lot of reports that the rebels are actually losing this war. What was their attitude toward the possibility of winning or losing?
Well, I do agree. First of all, they are losing this war. I think it's not reversible now. I don't even think if the West intervenes in some sort of way, it's going to change anything. So the rebels have lost a lot of strategic areas, and they'll never get it back. They don't have the hardware to do so. But at the end of the day, I really wonder if it's really what we want. You know, if we want Bashar al-Assad to go, or we want something else that's truly an unknown.
Speaking of intervention, did the rebels you were encountering both before and after your capture talk about the use of chemical weapons?
Yes. From the first time it happened, they became public recently, and then, you know, François Hollande and then Jim and Cameron and Barack Obama, everybody was very active publicly to say how wrong it was. It is wrong, obviously. But with that being said, I do not believe the Bashar al-Assad government did it. I am pretty convinced from my experience on the ground and, you know, sources and, mm-hmm. you know, that the Islamist portions of the rebellions are probably the ones who did it, not the Bashar al-Assad government.
What's an example of an indication that you think that the rebels might be behind this?
Well, for one thing, tactically, it really makes no sense to for Bashar al-Assad to use these chemical weapons because he's winning this conflict and he knows the consequences of using them. So he can still win by using conventional weapons. So using them makes no sense whatsoever. That's the main argument. Mm-hmm. And number two, there are reports now that are coming out that Saudi Arabia might have supplied the rebels with chemical weapons. And, you know, once it's in Syria, it's hard to control. You don't know who has them. And we also know for a fact that Islamist portions of the rebellions have captured in the past stocks of chemical weapons. And these guys will not hesitate to use them and blame it on the government mm-hmm. so they can get help from the West.
Okay. Would you go back to Syria and work again?
No, I think that's it for me. And I was told not to by various people. Because I'm known now that I was captured, money was paid, so I'm assuming other people would try to capture me again. So.
And you've been reunited with your family. Tell us what that was like.
Well, I was in Beirut for a while because at the French embassy, because I had no documents, so the French government helped me out to leave the country because I really wasn't welcome in Lebanon anymore for various reasons. And so I went back to Paris for a week, and I've met my family in New York when I came back, and they met me at the airport.
Okay. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us, and we all wish you luck in your next foray into a war zone and appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you.
That was an interview with photojournalist Jonathan Alperi, recorded in September of this year. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. The show is directed by Travis McMillan with audio by Pat Akers. I'm Raymond Tungekar, filling in for David Reed. Please join us again next week for another Global Journalist.